and welcome to this, another episode of Frame and Reference. I'm your host, Kenny McMillan, and today I'm talking with Maria Rushi, DP of the film Shiva Baby, which premiered at South by Southwest last year, and TIFF, and premiered theatrically in April. She also worked on season two of Showtime's Couples Therapy. She got another movie coming out called Dating in New York. So doing the work, and also as an adjunct professor at NYU, the Tisch School for the Arts. So an absolute wealth of knowledge. I feel like I refer to too many people as having a wealth of knowledge. I need a thesaurus. But in any case, I had a great, great conversation with Maria. It sounded like we were both cut from the similar sort of nerdy cloths in regards to our love of sci-fi. So we got to get into that a little bit. And, I got to learn some tips from her, because let's be honest, when you have someone whose job is education to come on a podcast that is ostensibly about cinematography education, that's going to be a good episode. I think you're all going to thoroughly enjoy this one. So without talking too much, as usual, I'm going to shut up. Here's my conversation with Maria Rushi. I like to start every podcast just asking, like, how did you get involved in cinematography? Were you always a visually oriented person?
Not incredibly, but I went to film school because I thought maybe I wanted to be an editor. And when I got there and saw that, there were other options of there were other departments, basically. Basically, I saw what the DP was doing, and that role is really collaborating with the director and then turning around and actualizing that vision with the crew by leading and delegating. And I grew up playing team sports, and that really made sense to me, and was a slot that I fit into very well. So I started doing that. I started in lighting. So I worked as a gaffer and electrician and shot tons of short films and kind of like worked my way up that way. That's kind of how I started in cinematography.
It's actually great that you say that, because I've been having this conversation with a handful of my friends about, you know, there's a million kinds of two kinds of people, but the one that I keep running into is what I've called athletes versus academics. So, which you could say jocks versus nerds, but this is more applicable. And I think, like, every job, especially now that you can look things up, you can research, you can listen to a podcast and get the knowledge, the academics, which I consider myself one of, I was not necessarily an athlete growing up. I did snowboarding, but that's not a team sport. The academics have more velocity into careers, but generally I have found fail because they don't know the team aspect. So what sport were you playing?
I played soccer was my number one, but I played baseball as well. And I think that's totally right, because I've been teaching actually at NYU for a few years. And I always tell my students, you know, I think it's not my original idea, but I think DPing is you know, a third aesthetic, a third artistic, a third technical, and a full third managerial. You know, the job very much is understanding interpersonal relationships and how to speak to people, to communicate what you need to communicate, and how to interact as part of a team to get things done. I mean, so much of the job in prep obviously is spitballing ideas, all that sort of fun stuff, camera tests, things like that. But once you get on set, like, if you can't delegate, you can't lead a team, you're not really going to be able to execute your vision. So I think that's, I guess you'd call maybe a soft skill that's somewhat harder to teach academically. And that was something I was really trying to bring into the curriculum because I think it's crucial. Yeah.
Can you give me sort of a primer to how you approach that, how you are able to articulate that to students? Like, here's what we're going to try to learn here, and kind of maybe some analogies that you may use to get the film kids on board. Because I'm going to assume, like the film school that I went to, the social skills are not great, especially in college.
Totally. Well, I mean, I start off the class kind of setting that as the context and as the tone, and kind of explain, when I was in film school, it sounds similar to your experience. The classes were very technical, really tech forward, and it gave, I understand in hindsight why that was, because that's what they think you're there to learn, how to use the equipment. But what I think it actually did was tell students that if you're not a tech, you know, a tech, what do you call it? Like
tech focused kind of person.
Yeah. Like if you're not well versed in the tech, then you're not going to make a good DP. And I saw a ton of really talented people not go down the path of cinematography because they felt like they didn't see themselves in what was being presented to them. So I always start the semester by basically telling that story and saying that, you know, managing a team, like you can produce great work on your own to a certain level. And after that point, you need to be able to work with a team. You need to be able to delegate. And if you can't do that, like this maybe isn't the job for you, but you can, you know, you can learn how to do that, obviously. But that means in a lot of our exercises, I try to incorporate the element of running the team, and that's kind of like part of how they're graded on their assignment. So for example, one of our, one thing we do by the end of the semester is shoot kind of a one or two shot idea. And part of what they're figuring out is not just how to set up the lighting, but the cadence of how you shoot a scene. And that starts from the blocking rehearsal. And that starts from how do you communicate your idea to your team? And that's these prep materials. You have an overhead, you might have a shot list that you're showing your team and reference images. And then these folks know kind of what your goal is. And that way you can communicate with them about what it is that you're trying to execute, right? So that becomes as much part of the exercise as like, this is how you set up an HMI. This is how you run power, things like that.
Yeah, I will say that the other end of that spectrum was I'm pretty technologically minded, and that I went to New York Film Academy before I went to college, and New York Film Academy, like, people have differing opinions on it, but as a high schooler, I did their like 6-week program, invaluable. Then I got to college and very tech forward and also very hands off. It felt they were kind of just like this is Arizona State and the school had just started the film school. So they're probably still finding their footing. I don't know what they're doing now, but you know, our capstone was really like, all right, build your crew, come back when you need us. Huh? You know, and so the making everything tech minded gave me a huge false sense of competence that I did not have. You know, I was like, I know how to run a camera. I should be able to make a movie. It's no.
Totally. No, and even so, I definitely struggled with that when I first started, especially because I think as you're learning to light specifically, you start to get angle and you start to understand like the relationship between quality and intensity or color, but you can't quite articulate it. And so you really just want to move the light yourself because you're like, I just need to, I think, go a little bit this way, and you want to move yourself, or you want to like stick it up, stick it down yourself. And that doesn't, you know, you reach a point obviously where you can't do that.
Well, sure, the union will get in the way.
Well, that too.
When you came up in the lighting department, were there any like things that you remember specifically learning that you were like, oh, that's changed the game for me? Or was it just kind of a sliding scale of knowledge that you sort of inherited?
I would say mostly the latter, because I, as a second child, find it invaluable to learn by watching somebody else do it first, especially because like the pressure is taken off a bit. But I worked kind of on a lot of union jobs as an electrician for a couple of years. And that was a really actually crucial experience for me because it really demystified a lot of the tech, I'd say, and a lot of this fear that there was something that bigger budget movies knew or had that I didn't know. And what I realized was that they are using the same principles that we've learned, you know, that a larger source is still going to make a softer light. They just knew how to do it very efficiently. And they had more money to have maybe bigger units or bigger rags, but they didn't, nothing about the principles was different. And that was really, really a light bulb moment, I think, for me, that gave me a lot more, helped me build my confidence in lighting and in shooting.
Have you always worked on the East Coast? Have you ever worked on the West Coast?
I really mostly worked on the East Coast. I have done not much on the West Coast. And, you know, as you know, it's like all of my jobs are word of mouth. So sure. That has kind of just been where the web has expanded after NYU. But that's been the bulk of my experience.
Well, I was going to ask if you had noticed any difference between the sort of shooting styles between the two coasts, or maybe between even New York and Boston. Have you noticed like a crew difference as you've perhaps worked around, or is it all the language is the same no matter what?
You know, I know other people have noticed that, but I haven't noticed it a ton. I mean, I was working in Alabama recently, and we had a local gaffer in Key Grip, and they were excellent. I mean, the communication style was the same as what I had been used to. So I haven't noticed an incredible difference.
Sure.
Have you?
So I've only worked in LA. So couldn't, everyone's, you know, LA is definitely the, what everyone says it is, but it's also kind of, I feel like it might be the same in New York. It's like, it is kind of what you make it. I think probably the downside to LA is it's just so spread out, and it's so, difficult to network in a sense, because, it's hard to have a friend group that isn't where the same group that you work with,
mm-hmm.
you know, and also people move here specifically to work. And so you end up with a lot of folks. Like, I'm not from here. I'm from the Bay Area and San Francisco area. And, there's a documentary, a great one called Fog City Mavericks, about all the filmmakers that came out of or made their mark in the Bay Area. And the big thing there was like when they're done working, they would go hang out with their friends and talk about other shit. And that doesn't really happen down here. And I think that's a detriment to people working because then they just kind of become neurotic.
Totally. I've definitely visited LA, and I have to say that was something that sort of scared me about LA was that everybody seems to be in the film industry and talking about the industry. And I appreciate the friends I have here who are either not in the industry or just the friends that we are able to talk about other things. I think it does give a good balance and perspective to be able to kind of step away a little bit.
Well, that's where all the stories come from, right? The most head up your ass thing you can make is the film about filmmaking. Like, how many of those have we seen? We're just like, all right, yeah, good, fine. Mm-hmm.
How many
adaptation, like that's a good one.
I know. I was it's funny because I just watched Adaptation for the first time and I was thinking of that one and I was like, yeah, but they kind of like did a good job. But besides that one,
when you were coming up or like just kind of finding your feet, were there any specific influences that you had or any films that you were like, that's what I want to do?
You know, I felt a little kind of out of place, I think, in film school because I was not a traditional cinephile, so to speak.
Me neither, trust me.
Yeah. I always loved comedy and sci-fi growing up. And you know, they seem unrelated, but I think that they both involve kind of like world building and give you an opportunity to think about an idea or like an existential, you know, topic in a fun way. And I really like that, really that really helped me. Like that really worked for me. Comedies and like sci-fi really worked for me. And I just didn't, I felt definitely a little embarrassed in film school to not care that much about Citizen Kane. And
I was literally about to say that.
Yeah, totally. And, but since I, you know, in the time since then, I've gotten a lot, obviously more, okay with my own taste and I always, I mean, I love like Bill Pope's work and career, I think is like iconic. I mean,
yes, 100%.
The Matrix is my favorite movie. And he also shot Scott Pilgrim and Clueless. Are you kidding me? Like what a combo.
I literally, when I started this podcast, I was like, if I could have Bill Pope, me and Josh Richards, I think, me and someone were talking about, I was like, if I could get Bill Pope on this joint just talk about his career, I would be set for life.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. Just shoot the shit with Bill Pope. And I mean, Cosmos, even he shot, like what a weird sprinkling of all my interests in one. I've gotten more kind of, I found other people who have the same, interests that I do and value that. So that's been really great.
Yeah. If you could not tell, I'm in the exact same boat. I recently just started like finally going, okay, let me start attempting to eat. Cause you know, I really want to watch The Matrix, Men in Black, The Phantom. Did you ever see The Phantom with Billy Zane, Catherine Zeta-Jones? It's like a pulpier Indiana Jones based on a comic book. It's fantastic. It's super like, not dumb, but it's just It's very well made, but it's kind of corny. But I love it. But I never, yeah, I was never watching. Basically, if it's on Criterion, I didn't see it. So now these days when I'm a smarter filmmaker, I'm like, all right, I can actually, like, we just watched The Red Shoes the other night, which is not something I would choose to watch on my own volition. But my girlfriend is a dancer. And so she, I bought a bunch of Criterions and she was like, you bought The Red Shoes? I was like, I did. Let's watch it. And I can appreciate it now. You know, I can, not only am I, as an adult, more willing to watch stories that are not built for me, but sort of take them apart, you know, as a cinematographer. Were you able to go to the Matrix 20th anniversary screenings?
No.
And oh, I'm no.
actually beside myself because I was at another, I was watching Parasite at the Nighthawk. And we came out of the theater, obviously incredible movie. And I look at the marquee and it says like The Matrix at midnight or something. And I almost had a fit. I like didn't know about it somehow. So that was deeply upsetting, but I just watched it again at home. So
it was, so I think I saw it for like my birthday. It came out like in the summer, right around when my birthday was. And this is just going to rub dirt in your wounds. But like, I remember sitting there, and of course it's in the like, not IMAX, but like the Dolby Vision, like the full redo. And there were just little things that like you don't pick up on either the VHS or the DVD back in the day. But like opening scene, right? You're flying through the Matrix code. The black behind it is more code. Like there's more there. You could also tell how cheaply most of the sets were were built.
Love that.
The hotel room that Trinity's in is clearly just at the very beginning, just clearly just like painted plywood in a box. Like there's no, but that shit makes me excited. I'm like, okay, well, if it's the story, like it just reinforces, like it's the story that matters. If you can get away with that and still have it be this iconic, or just stealing the set from what was it, Dark Crystal, the rooftop set. They just stole that from a different set that was filming at the same time.
Why not?
Fuck totally. It.
Looks good.
Yeah. Was that fantasy, I think fantasy films especially can spark joy in most filmmakers, I would hope. You know, who watches something, who watches Schindler's List and goes, I want to make films? It's like, okay, kid.
Yeah, we worry about those kids, but they inspire us for sure. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And I mean, I think that's also, I'm sure that that's how some people relate to the world, obviously, right? But right. I think what I have come to realize is what I think of as art, I guess, or what makes an impact on me is something that makes me understand something about life or about myself. And just personally, it's usually comedy or sci-fi for me, because you're able to explore like a premise like, are we living in a simulation? That's right. Awesome. That is meaningful to me and helps me kind of learn about myself.
Well, and too, I feel like the further away you get from a representation of a current reality, the more willing you are to give yourself to the ideas being presented.
I think that's exactly right. Yeah, I think that is exactly right. And why, you know, it's sometimes more difficult when it's an exact representation of reality to project anything else onto it. Because it's you're so specifically watching exactly the experience of someone, for example, instead right. of being able to kind of project all these other ideas about what's happening like you can onto something that's not hyper realistic.
Yeah. What were some of the comedies that you grew up loving?
I did famously Interview for Harvard senior year and tell the gentleman that my favorite film was Anchorman. I didn't get in, but that was, I did watch a lot of, I think, how do I say it? Like physical comedy, I really enjoyed. I mean, the Coen brothers, for sure. Yeah.
For me, it was my not getting accepted thing was saying really early on, I was like, I love Kevin Smith's movies. I want to do that. And everyone went, well, you're not going to do that here, kid.
Yeah, you will be doing that somewhere else.
You can do that on your own. That's what he taught you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He did teach us that. Yeah.
If you really need to do it yourself. Yeah, Anchorman's a great one, though. When you're lighting, because you've, what's it, Shiva Baby is a comedy, right?
I would call it a comedy.
Or maybe like a dark comedy.
Dark comedy, yeah.
Very. We love a dark comedy.
We love that, we love that. Yeah, I mean, it's funny because that, I thought a very funny script when I got it, but it's, I had seen the short, I didn't shoot the short, and so much of the humor is this kind of serious situation and the context beneath kind of what they're saying and the characters. And so I brought in actually a lot of like dramatic references when I met with Emma, because I mean, we looked, of course, or we talked about A Serious Man, but really I remember the first images on my like mood board I showed her basically were from Shame, the Steve McQueen movie, and which is a deeply unfunny film. And, but what we were kind of looking at was how to set up this sort of more dramatic, maybe environment and take it very seriously. And, it was more important to use the camera work to show the paranoia and the anxiety, because the comedy would come from the performance opposing that, or from the dialogue in that, within that environment, rather than shooting it more traditionally like a comedy.
Yeah. So sort of, obviously it's different for every setup and every scene, but like, what was kind of your go-to sort of lighting setup, lighting package for the show, for the movie?
So we designed basically the lighting for the first half of the movie to be daylight. You know, we still wanted to feel a little dark in the house, but we looked at this movie called Las Herederas, which is I think Argentinian film that has a lot of like really beautiful kind of dark interiors, daylight interiors. And we referenced that a lot, and that meant a lot of M18s outside the windows, and using like a light mat or something inside to wrap what was coming in through the windows. And, you know, just to like back up slightly, this is why I make sure I'm involved in the location scouting portion of the prep process, because, you know, it's crucial for us to have basically a ground floor location, because we couldn't afford lifts or anything, and enough kind of windows or motivation for lighting within the space. So in the first half of the film, that was usually daylight units outside. But then, you know, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to make the visual language progress as we go on, and just not feel so stagnant inside this one location for the whole film. And one thing we came up with was having it get warmer as we went on, And I, you know, talked with the production designer a lot about how to motivate that change. And that was partially like lighting candles or turning lamps on, closing curtains, things like that. So once we started doing that, you know, it was a lot more practical, motivated, warmer sources. And that was a lot of like light mats in the air inside.
The light mats are getting huge these days. Like I remember when they first came out and they just weren't powerful enough to do anything. And now every single DP I've interviewed so far is using them.
They're great, man. Yeah. I mean, it's so crazy to think about how we made soft light before that.
Right.
Because it was a nightmare. I mean, I remember working on shows, I mean, and using them myself, like hanging like a 1K with a chimera on it or something. It's like that shit's so heavy and like right. takes so much room, gets so hot, uses so much power. I you try to use them for what I think their best use is, which is to me a soft light that can like wrap a maybe slightly harder key light. I like to put muslin on them for that purpose because I think that the texture just feels a little bit more natural.
You're putting muslin on the light mat.
Yeah.
So you got to, man, they are powerful now these days.
They're powerful. They're powerful, especially the Series 2, which is what we had on Chibi Baby was they got a good amount of punch. But that's the thing is you don't need that much out of that wrap unit. It's really just to smooth out the key light.
Are you a big, two things that I've kind of seen a lot of people, this is not like a divisive question. I just framed it like it is. Top light and catch lights. What's your opinion? Some DPs are very like, I never want to see a fake eye light in my thing. And a lot of people are like, I'll put that little aperture right on the top of the mat box. Call it a day.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, totally. It's tough because I mean, I love an eye light, right? Who doesn't, but I definitely try to design the blocking and lighting so that we're getting one naturally. If it makes sense for the scene. But sometimes it doesn't. And sometimes it doesn't work that way, but you know, on shot a movie called Milkwater that recently came out as well. And we, our lead actor, you know, it's tough to get light in his eyes sometimes. And I ended up using something I never thought I would, which was just basically a little candy bar and like trying to catch a little bit of light from whatever he or Phil we were using and reflect a little bit of something in his eye. And we needed that to feel his performance a little bit more.
He wasn't a zombie.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think I definitely prefer an eye light that is working because that's where the lighting is set. Right. You know, ideally the fill, for example, is in the direction that they're facing. So you're catching a little bit of something in their eye. So I'm rarely adding a little LED light to the top of camera. It's kind of a last resort, I'd say. But yeah, I hear you on the top lighting. It's interesting, kind of just as a like raising ambience a little bit to instead of having like a more specific fill unit, you know, more kind of like brush stroke lighting, I guess. Yeah. And I guess I'm finding that I think partially because the cameras are getting so sensitive that I'm needing it less and less. So when I do use it, it's usually like a fill unit.
Right.
Maybe up in the air or something like that.
Or just motivated by whatever's up there.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, that's the interesting thing I've found is, so recently, yesterday, I pulled my XL2 out of storage. And I was goofing around with that, and I have shot 16 millimeter before, and both things reminded me, like, we used to have to be so careful with how you lit things, but also way more power. Like, I think the XL2 is rated at, like, 160.
Mm.
So it was bright as hell in here, and it still looked a little too dark. And now it's like, if you're 1% up on the back of the LED unit, it your false colors go out of whack.
It looks crazy.
Do you find it harder to light? Did you ever shoot film?
Yeah, I learned on film. And I think it's invaluable for understanding exposure, just because you're forced to. And I've definitely noticed with my students, like if they're not forced to do something, you won't do it, right? You'll take kind of the short
sure.
But totally, as far as kind of the lighting differences, it is interesting lighting for a more sensitive camera, you know. And just in terms of controlling what you're seeing and what you're not seeing, right? I mean, now you're seeing everything. And I don't know, I think it's exciting because you maybe don't have to use such powerful units, and it's maybe a slightly like a democratization of filmmaking. But I'm trying to think how do you feel like it's influenced how you light?
I've found that at first, I think this would probably be more like what your students would say. At first, I thought I could light with not reckless abandon, but I thought I could be less precise and still get away with it. Oh, I'll bring that down in the grade. The info's there. But even, you know, one stop up on the skin makes the skin a little peaky and doesn't look the way I want. And so I found myself, I think I was getting a little too fire hosey with light, and I was like, okay, I just bring it back, bring it all back, using a lot more neg. Now I've asked a few DPs about that. Like, do you find yourself just flying like 12 by Doovie and just
all the time? Oh my God.
Kill yeah, half totally. The set with it.
Totally. Yeah. Especially on Shiva Baby, I typically am, really vocal about it's not going to look dark if the walls are white. So what are we going to do about this? But we had white walls, and that worked out because, you know, we did a number of production design things to kind of still keep it feeling darker in there. But I was absolutely having our key grip tape duve to the wall, like all the time. Anything off screen had kind of duve tape to the wall or like the ceiling a lot of times. Because totally you're needing to remove a lot more light than you would have.
Well, and it's that funny balance of like, it needs just enough where the shadows aren't noisy, but not too much that, and it depends on the sensor, obviously. Like I primarily shoot Canon, and they're very finicky. They want everything in the middle. You know, or you can get away with a lot more up top. What was your shooting package on Shiva Baby?
We shot with actually, it's a good question. I'm like, did we shoot in there? We shot on the Alexa Plus 4x3 sensor. We got a package from Panavision. They've been like incredibly supportive since I was in film school. They hook it up for sure. And we're able, you know, I kind of was pitching them on like, this movie takes place all inside a house. It would make the movie to have anamorphic lenses for this. Like, it really would make a huge difference for us. What do you think? And they got us a set of Kawas. And that, I think, was crucial for making the house feel both like it was kind of caving in on Danielle at times, but also I knew we were going to have a ton of shots with multiple characters in frame, like playing off of each other, that was going to be a lot of kind of composition or blocking interaction. And I wanted to make sure we could shoot, you know, a three shot without having to be on like a 25 or something and just feel no depth, you know?
Have them doing the Star Trek composition.
Yeah, exactly.
They're all like,
everyone get in a row and we'll just kind of like look down the row. But totally. I mean, that I think really was crucial to me in helping, you know, tell the story through lens choice, which is always a struggle.
Yeah. Well, plus going back to the idea of film school, you do anything to raise the production value, and some sick anamorphics will sky up that budget look.
Yeah. I mean, you know, of course we wanted to be sure, we looked at like, we were testing like some Crystal Express, lenses as well. And they just looked insane. And it's like, I needed to make sure that it wasn't going to distract or like totally morph how someone's face looked. I knew we were going to be so tight on Rachel so much of the time. And so in testing, I did a lot of testing with Rachel's face and looking at the edges of the lenses, and also looking at like a three shot and how crazy it looked at the edges. And we ended up only shooting the kind of climactic, like, scene where Danielle freaks out and her parents like sing to her. That was like the only scene we shot on the 40, because it is so extreme in its look. And I didn't want you to be thinking too much about that, obviously, during the most of the movie.
Well, that's the what's his face, the Wes Anderson look, right? He shoots everything on that primo 40, I think.
Good for him. I mean, that is a lovely lens, and I think a spherical 40 is
the butter zone.
Yeah, a spherical 40 really does something nice for me, but the Kawa 40 less. So.
Well, and the other thing too is like if you were to go super modern, like the what are the master anamorphics? There's like no character to them, so it's like, well, at that point, just shoot spherical and go wide, because like, what are you, J.J. Abrams? You really need that flare in there.
You have the flare, man. How are you going to sell it without the flare?
That's what goes in the trailer.
Yes.
Just flare, flare, flare. Okay. Drone.
I would have watched that, though. In high school, I would have watched.
You've shot a lot of commercials, right?
I do shoot commercials. Yeah. I would say I shoot primarily narrative, but I'm lucky enough to kind of fill in with commercials, which is great.
How have those, I thought of a different question. Okay, all right, we'll jump back around. How's your narrative work compared to your, not like the work that you do, but how do you approach shooting commercials versus narratives? Is there a different workflow, or because obviously you have to be faster?
Yes and no, I'd say.
Okay.
Just because I think a lot of the commercials that I've done, you know, the process of approval through a client is just totally, totally different than my experience has been shooting a movie. And, you know, I'm sure if some like studio execs are giving their feedback, maybe that's more similar. But But no, I mean, there's on commercials, it's just the process of getting things approved is a lot more difficult. So it's been just a lot like more, it's everything is storyboarded. And any, there's not much room to change that once you get to set and realize like maybe this looks a little bit cooler. Which is fine. I mean, I am happy to kind of execute the vision. And I think it's, I think it gives an opportunity to work with more like big equipment, I suppose, which is,
sure,
is helpful to kind of try certain things out or, yeah, really kind of execute something very specific. So yeah, as far as kind of like the differences between working style there, I'd say sometimes it's even a little more comfortable than features timing wise. I have found the schedule somewhat more, you know, comforting.
Sure. Is it kind of like a thing where, because there's not maybe, this is kind of a, maybe an obtuse way to put it, but like there's not as much creativity in a commercial because it's so pre-planned and you know, like the car comes here, we have to see it, we have to see the logo, boom, 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 and you can knock it out versus a narrative piece where you, there's a lot more conversations about like, oh, what, you know, the what ifs are like, how do they feel here? Whereas Ford is like, we want to see the car.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, there's, it's somewhat more straightforward, right? And somewhat more of an immediate, an immediacy to it, because, which is also fun because you have this shot of the car coming in that you are trying to nail and you nail that shot and you got it. And like, that feels very good. And that feeling is a lot more drawn out, I think, on a feature because you're coming up with these ideas so much farther in advance and then you're spending time like shooting other stuff. And when you finally get to that moment, maybe it's changed a little or maybe you improve upon it. But you're just not getting that the immediate gratification of like, we shot the thing the way that we meant to shoot it.
Yeah, sure. The question I forgot about was, do you have any tips for shooting in a white-walled room? Because I'm sure a lot of students, I'm sure, you know, whatever apartment they're going to film in is going to have white walls.
That's a tough one because I do think something I often say to directors too is, you know, we can shoot on the most expensive camera that we can find and we can shoot, you know, a trash can and it's still going to look like a trash can. So what's in front of the camera really has to look good before it's captured. But I mean, that being said, you know, there are things you can do with production design. Think like you were mentioning, if there's, you know, ways you can fill the space of the wall with something like a lamp that breaks up just the white wall and gives you a little bit of a gradient or gives you just a point of interest, I think really helps. Another thing I do a lot is use a lot of control grids. And I feel like in LA they call them like
honey crates.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was the other thing you said? It cut out.
Modifiers or something.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But there's like control grids for light mats or for, I always have them for like 4x4 diffusion frames too. I mean, those are crucial in controlling soft light all the time, but also in a room like that. I think those are your best friend for sure. And
totally.
And negative fill, like we were saying.
Yeah. Oh, Honey Crates is a brand. What do they call them? Egg crates.
So they make like soft versions of those that are like 40 degrees or 50 degrees that are a bit longer, and they'll
right.
they can like snap onto the light mats or onto your 4x4 frame, and like they're amazing.
Yeah. No, that's a great point. Because especially to like, I guess that would replace in some ways the barn doors of your, just a lot of them.
I mean, that's exactly how I teach it, is like, if the goal of soft light is to spread the light rays and have them bounce around as much as possible, well, we're putting tiny little barn doors every inch on this light so that it's can be directional, but still, it's still a large source and still soft.
Is there anything that your students have taught you that surprised you?
That is such a good question. I love seeing the democratization basically of filmmaking, which I think has happened more with cameras being accessible at a like lower price point. And I've been really impressed at the, I guess, visual literacy of the kids coming in, because they do understand, I think they understand kind of coverage or what they want to see in the frame pretty well, because they've been shooting like videos on their iPhones since they were 10, I guess.
Right.
So that's been interesting to check in with.
Is what do you think is the sort of top one or two things that you're consistently seeing need that students today need to improve on? What are they missing? Because I've always wondered how, like, sort of, I guess you would call them the YouTube generation. They know so much. We all know so much because of people have shared things on YouTube or elsewhere on the internet, forums, a lot of great forums out there. But then there's those institutional knowledges, that institutional knowledge that you end up missing.
Yeah. You know, I do think that, like I was saying before, there is a tendency for all people to not do a thing unless you need to, or not learn a thing unless you need to. And so much on digital cameras is manipulatable by like pressing a button, you know, you
right.
can like make it brighter or darker. And that's why I have them shoot on 16 to kind of start, because
oh, that's perfect.
I do think it's still crucial to understand exposure and understand the elements that go into creating an exposure and being able to measure your lighting, or at least look at a monitor, like monitor literacy, like being able to understand what your scopes are telling you, and how that's interacting with the camera sensor. And that's an area where I think, since they're not forced to learn it, because they can turn on their camera and like get a nice image by opening or closing the iris or like pressing the ISO button. I think consistently that's an area there.
One question that I ask everyone, is, well, there's two, but I start with this one. Is there either a life change or a piece of equipment maybe, or a educational thing that happened to you or that you own or whatever, that you can point to that you think most helped you in your career thus far, or at least not number one most, but like just that kind of comes off your head?
That is a good question. I think that I hope this answers your question, but I think that realizing that networking could just be hanging out with people who you think are cool, who you get along with, was really a game changer for me, because it's so much, as you know, so much of the job of being a DP is meeting people, and kind of like they need to call you to work. You can't apply for a job, so you need to be called, and so people need to know you. That really not only helped me enjoy it more, but it just I've been brought to, I think, all of my jobs, basically, especially my features, by people who I've gotten along with who've recommended me, basically. And that has led to the best projects, because I'm putting in effort with people I get along with, and that has led to being recommended to projects with people I also get along with, because it just makes sense that people you like will introduce you to people who are also similar minded, I suppose. And it's really worked out well, because Emma is one of my very good friends now. I mean, she lived two blocks away from me while we were shooting Shiva Baby. And Morgan, who directed Milkwater, is also one of my very good friends now, and she lives also two blocks away from me. And that's just made all of this very rewarding, because you need to make movies with people you care about and want to see them succeed. Because otherwise you'll make a bad movie.
Yeah. That two blocks away thing must also be the New York magic. There's no two blocks away out here.
There's no blocks.
That's 2 hours away. Yeah, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but tell me if you agree. The other thing I think that's important for folks listening, it's important to meet people that you want to be friends with. It's important to hang out with them. It's also important to not treat those relationships as if they're work leads. You're not mining people for, you got to treat them like people. I think it can be very easy, especially out here. It's very easy to like meet people and be like, that's my director friend. That's all they're good for. I will only talk to them when it's work time.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that's kind of the shift that's part of the shift in thinking that I was talking about, because I stopped. I mean, I made sure I wasn't seeing people as a way to get somewhere. And I think that networking was pitched like that a lot to me in film school. And yes. I'm sure also I just interpreted it that way for sure. But
I think we all do. And I think it was pitched to all of us the same way.
Yeah, totally. Because I just let go of that. And I was like, I focused a lot more on who I actually got along with and who was fun to hang out with or talk to. And it's so much easier to keep in touch with those people, because they're just become your friends, and you like DM them a meme that you saw that you both like. And it's not just a business relationship, you know, it's building a community of people you get along with who also want to make cool stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's perfect. Second question, probably the easiest one. Anything you want to promote?
Totally. Shiva Baby is available on VOD right now. And Milkwater, which was one of my first features, shot 3 years ago. That is a say dramedy about a woman who meets an older gay man at a bar and agrees to become his surrogate, hoping it'll give her life some purpose. And it's a super funny, heartfelt movie. I really love that one. And I actually have another movie, Dating in New York, which is going to be at Tribeca. And that movie is kind of it's a more classic rom-com in structure. It's about two, you know, folks in their early 20s who meet on a dating app and decide to try to be friends with benefits. Will it work out? Who knows? But it's more kind of surreal in style. So we had a ton of fun kind of like creating these more magical realism moments. And that one I'm very excited for sure.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for spending the hour with me. I really enjoyed that conversation. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is so great. A fellow Matrix freak. I love this one.
Frame and Reference is an Owlbot production. It's produced and edited by me, Kenny McMillan, and distributed by Pro Video Coalition. Our theme song is written and performed by Mark Pelly, and the FNR Mapbox logo was designed by Nate Truax of Truax Branding Company. You can read or watch the podcast you just heard by going to ProVideoCoalition.com or YouTube.com/Owlbot, respectively. And as always, thanks for listening.